1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13. Therefore, prepare your minds for action. Keep sober in spirit. Fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. That, of course, is the American Standard Version, New American Standard Version there. And if you read this in other translations, you'll find that there are some differences. There are several translations, rather than have prepare your minds, it'll have gird your minds. And some will have gird up the loins of your mind. That's all metaphoric language, and we'll be looking at that in just a little bit. I think this is one case where the New American Standard wanted to get the thought across, and so the idea is prepare, and we'll see how that works in there. But actually, the original language would be exactly as it reads in the King James, gird up the loins of your mind. Now, Peter's letter was written to Christians who were spread out over a large region. We looked at that in the first lesson in this series. And what he had to convey to them was pertinent, though, wherever they might happen to be. They needed to keep in mind that wherever they were, it was not their home. They were temporary residents here, and some of them, and it's impossible to say to what extent, were suffering persecution. And again, it's difficult to say how much or what kind. In 1 Peter chapter 1 and in verse 6, in this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials. Now, the various trials, or you might have temptations there. But probably trials might be the right word. And you look at that and you think other things. And yeah, you can begin to see that that's probably talking about, you know, the trials that come along with some form of persecution and the temptation, you know, to just give up the faith and to think, well, it's not worth it to endure something like this. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 17 is another place. For it is better, if God should will it so, that you suffer for doing what is right rather than for doing what is wrong. Now, this again would go along with the idea that some of them were suffering. Well, but you're suffering for what's right. That's better than suffering for something that's wrong. And of course, Christians ought to do the thing that's right, not the wrong thing. In 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 10, he says, after you have suffered for a little while, the God of all grace who called you to his eternal glory in Christ will himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. Well, now that could mean that it might continue the suffering, but it also could mean that the suffering might cease after a while. Look at that either way. But back in chapter 4 and in verse 12, it seems like that there was an impending spell coming of worse persecution. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing or proving, as though some strange thing were happening to you. To be forewarned is to be forearmed. But it certainly appears there that there might be an increase in things, and to be ready for that. Now, all of these things serve as a refining fire. They're going to prove you or test you. In 1 Peter chapter 1 again, and verse 7. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 7. So that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So now there he's talking about how gold, and how gold is tested by fire, or it's proved by fire. Now, the proving is that the the gold goes through a smelting process to refine it and to purify it. And his point here is that, well, you know, persecution does the same thing. It shows what you're made out of. And a lot of times it purifies things. Now, it might ruin things and change things dramatically, but in the end, it's going to prove what you are, to test you in this way. The particular exhortation in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 13 deals with keeping the proper focus. There's actually a main point here, and then there's two subsidiary points. The main point is to fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you. The two subsidiary points lend to or lead to the main point, and they are to gird or prepare your minds for actions. And then the second one is to be sober. Now, this is in anticipation, and not necessarily in the present world, for a time when Christians will finally be home, if you will. Because at the very end of verse 13, he says that this is all going to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And the word there, revelation, sometimes there's a word that's used there, and it might mean the presence of Jesus Christ. And that could mean a lot of different things. But that's not the word that's used here. The word that's used here is the apocalypse word. And the word normally that's translated as apocalypse. And what that word means, it would be like, you know, one of the shows I like to watch, the American Pickers. And they go out there, and I'm interested in it only so far. If it's got old motorcycles or cars, I'm all for it. But a jug or a lamp or a fan or something like that, not so much, you know. But to see, you know, every once in a while they'll go someplace and they go in some old barn, you know, and it's just dirty and everything else, and nobody's been in there, and you can tell the only thing that's been in there is critters and birds and things like that. And they go over here and, oh yeah, I want to show you something over here, and here's something over there that's covered up. And you know, and they pull that cover off of there, and there's a complete, you know, Model T or something like this that's been sitting over there for, I don't know, 50 years, you know. And they're just stuck. Well, see, it's covered up. And when you pull the cover off, what does it do? It reveals what's hidden under the cover. That's what the word apocalypse means. It's a pulling back of uncovering. And so the idea is then, with the revelation of Jesus Christ and His coming, that there's going to be a pulling back of things that have been hidden away, and then they'll finally be revealed at that time. So this is when it's going to be, and that's when all things are going to melt away, and the saints will be welcomed. When they'll hear those words, "Well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of your Lord." Now, our first thing to look at, we're going to look at the main point first, and that is hope as an anchor of the soul. I call your attention to something that's found over in Hebrews chapter 6. You know, we sing the song. I've always liked the song. Will your anchor hold in the storms of life? The idea of an anchor. And here you find in Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 19, this hope we have as an anchor of the soul. Obviously, it's where the idea for the song comes from. It is a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil. And so as an anchor of our soul, you know, the hope, That's what keeps things steady and keeps things intact, if you will. Now, but it's a hope that has a kind of an anticipation to it. When you hope for something, you don't have it. And then when you have it, well, you don't hope for it anymore. Or whatever that is. And you can probably think of lots of things that are that way. Something you've wanted for a long time, you had hope of one day perhaps owning whatever it is, and so you diligently saved a little bit here, there, and yonder, and then you're able to, you know, purchase whatever it is. Well, then where's the hope? Well, there's no hope anymore. But the hope that we have is not anything that might be, you know, in this life. Now, that's what he's talking, at least what he's talking about here in verse 13. We should have hope in this life, but not for hope for things in this life. Our hope ought to extend beyond that. That kind of hope is what he's talking about here. Look at Colossians chapter 1 and verse 5. And I think you'll see what I'm talking about here. Colossians chapter 1, verse 5. Because of the hope laid up for you in heaven, of which you previously heard in the word of truth, the gospel. So it's a hope that is resting in heaven. That's where our hope rests. And since we haven't attained that, we keep having the hope for that. See, that's the idea. In Romans, we'll go over there, Romans chapter 8, verses 24 and 25. For in hope we have been saved, but hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he already sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, well, with perseverance, we wait eagerly for it. And again, that goes along with the same idea. If you see it, there's no more hope involved in it because it's here, it's present, but there's something that you hope for that's really not in this realm. And I think that's what Romans is talking about. That's what Colossians is talking about. That's what they're talking about here in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13. And that hope, really, and the things hoped for, are kind of borne out in the context. So for just a moment here, let's look at some of these things here. Look at 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 4. Now, in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 4, to obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. So an inheritance reserved in heaven for you. Well, we'd be hoping for that, you see. And then what? How about verse 5? Who are protected by the power of God through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. Salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. Something that we're hoping for. You know, salvation's interesting. There's actually two salvations in the New Testament. First of all, there's salvation from past sins. You're saved from your sins. And then there's also a salvation. You're saved from the wrath to come. Now, the salvation all comes about because an individual obeys the gospel of Jesus Christ. Saved from sin, the wrath to come. It's not coming because now God's grace and mercy, as we talked about at length this morning, applies. And so there you have the salvation, the two senses, and how it all works. So salvation then ready to be revealed in the last time. That would be the fact that there's no wrath that's to come. In verse 7, we looked at this. Just look at the last part there. That it's going to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So praise, honor, glory. Well, when's that going to be? Well, at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Not here, not now, but later. And we'll be joint participants in this. And then also in verse 9, obtaining as the outcome or end of your faith the salvation of your souls. Things that we hope for. Now that's just looking at a few things in the context here that you find verse 13. How many other things are there throughout the scriptures that you see where there's a hope, where hope rests? How about the passage that talks about that there will not be any more pain and sorrow, no tears in heaven, how we sing about that? There's tears in this world, but no tears in heaven. And so many other things, and we just think about that. And of course, you know, it's the hope in there. And hope can go a long way in sustaining us, in keeping things going, if you will. The second thing we want to do, we want to look at the first of the subsidiary points, and that's being prepared for action. Now, as I said, when you look there at verse 13, prepare your minds for actions. It literally means, just as the King James says, gird up the loins of your mind, or your minds, either way. It might be translated. And some just have gird up your mind. But the idea here, this is an Oriental practice. You know, they wore these long robes, for centuries. Long, loose robes. We go all the way down to the ground. Over top of that, they'd have an outer garment that was a lot tougher and of a tougher material. And a lot of times, you know, they would take the outer garment off if they had to do some work or something like that. You can understand how it would free things up. But when you're going to do something, some kind of an action, Elijah, back in the Old Testament, Elijah took off on a run. He ran a long way. And he was running because of Jezebel and her promise to kill him. And of course he realized, you know, if he stayed where he was at, he was a marked man, it'd be over for him. So he took off. Well, what did he do right before he started on this monumental run? Well, he girded up. Well, what does that mean? They take the long robe, they get a hold of it right here, like this, and then they would pull it up and they would tuck it into the belt. That got it away from their feet. Now, obviously, if you're going to be running, that'd be a mighty handy thing, wouldn't it? But also they would do that if they had to work somewhere, out in the field or whatever the case might be. Now, sometimes you'll see these pictures that artists draw. For example, I remember seeing one time of the man out in the field, you know, sowing his field with wheat. Broadcasting it, you know, as he went along. And they had him in there, and they had it with the robes all the way down to the ground. I really doubt that. I just don't think you'd be doing that kind of a thing. You're going to be busy, you're working, you need the freedom of movement. That's what it's all about. So it's the gathering up of this and tucking them into belt and so on. And really what this tells us is that, well, you're removing an impediment. And then so the idea here is, from it's mixed metaphors there in there, you know, like loins of the mind and girding up and all that. It's mixed metaphors that are used here, and I think they're used effectively, because, you know, you get this out of the way and you can take care of it. And then what does it allow you to do? Well, it allows you to go about whatever actions are necessary. And we need to do that, you know, as Christians ourselves. Not literally, but we need to, you know, get rid of sometimes with these impediments. Back again in the Old Testament, in the book of Exodus, hopefully we're familiar with the idea that 10 plagues came upon Israel. After the 9th plague, came word from the Lord that they were to prepare themselves to leave. Not only so, but they were told to prepare a meal before they left. They were supposed to take a lamb that was so old and the physical condition ought to be of high quality. And they go on to other things. Now here's what you do, you know, you're going to have bread, but now when you make the bread, you don't put any leaven in it. Because the bread here is not, you don't have time to wait on that bread to rise. So it's unleavened bread. And so they're being prepared now, after the ninth plague. Because when the tenth plague hit, Pharaoh wanted these people out of town. He'd had enough. So he told them, okay, you can go over there, you know, and worship your God and take your cattle and your little ones with you and all that and everything, you know. He went right along with it. But it wasn't until later he changed his mind. He wanted them gone. Had enough of these people. What does it say there? Look with me at Exodus chapter 12. And verse 11 is what we want to focus our attention on. Exodus chapter 12 and verse 11. Now, discussing the meal that they were to eat, he says, you'll eat it in this manner, with your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. I think the bread was even called on occasions the bread of haste. You made it in kind of a hurry. But he ate it in a hurry too, because what's going to happen? Whenever they get the go-ahead from Pharaoh, we're out of here right now. We're not going to have time to look for your staff or for you to hunt around someplace, wherever you're at, looking for your sandals. You'd be ready to go, even to the point of having your loins girded. Not only are we going to leave, we're going to leave in a hurry. And so the idea is indeed to be prepared, as the American Standard Version would say. Now there's another one here, I think, that was kind of interesting. In Luke, chapter 17, when they're talking about the servants and their master and the relationship between the two of them and what's being done, and so on, and the slave out there, the servant is plowing, tending, he comes in from the field. Obviously, you know, he's tired, but his work is not done. Verse 7, you come immediately and sit down to eat. Does he say that to one of them? No. That's not what's said. But he says to him in verse 8, prepare something for me to eat, and properly clothe yourself, and serve me while I eat and drink, and afterward you may eat and drink. That properly clothe yourself means that you do whatever's necessary, because you're going to be busy serving me. Would that include girding up the garments? Be exactly what it would mean. So everything needs to be out of the way. Everything needs to be taken care of, because action, you're leading up to action involved. And all this, you know, again, is used as a metaphor. Think about it this way. What about our situation? I haven't seen anybody wearing a robe in, I have to admit, in a long time. No, we don't do that. But do we need to be prepared? Do we need to get impediments out of our way? Of course we do. Maybe a little different. Let's think about that for just a second. Many things need to be put away. Things like anxiety or worry, if you prefer the word. Either one works fine. How about fear? Obsession with material things. Let me ask you something. Can these things get in the way? Well, sure they get in the way. They get in the way all of the time. You know, I knew a lady. She's a member of the church. It didn't attend very often. What, you know? And what was she doing? She was sitting in the living room in a rocking chair, rocking. And what was she doing while she was rocking in the rocking chair? She was worried about dying. Worried about dying to the point that she didn't leave the rocking chair. Except maybe to, you know, for necessary things. And I just thought to myself, all this worry gets in the way of living. When you're worried about dying, you don't have any time for living. Was that in the way? Yeah. You know what?
It was in the way of serving God.
Yeah, the lady lived, I think, 15 more years. You know, so I guess maybe she was right. You know, we're all going to die some sooner or later. But I'm just using that as an example. And of course, obsession with material things. Has there ever been anybody that you know of, there's a member of the church, that just got so wrapped up in material things that the material things ended up owning them rather than the other way around? And what happened there? Well, they just had to work all the time to keep up with their material possessions and everything else. And what did happen with time for the Lord? Well, that's gone. Did it get in the way? Yeah, it got in the way. Will it get in the way with that hope that's supposed to be in heaven? Of course it will. Now, here's another thing that we might look at a couple things here. In Luke chapter 8, let's just look there. Luke chapter 8. Now, this is Luke's account of the parable of the sower. Luke chapter 8 and verse 14. Luke chapter 8, verse 14. The seed which fell among the thorns, these are the ones who have heard, and as they go on their way, they are choked with worries and riches and pleasures of this life and bring no fruit to maturity. Well, the impediments in the way got the upper hand, didn't it? And Luke chapter 21, verses 34 and 35. Be on guard, so that your hearts will not be weighted down with dissipation, carousing, some translations, and drunkenness and the worries of life, and that day will not come on you suddenly like a trap, for it will come upon all those who dwell on the face of all the earth. And what happens if you're worried all about those things and you're not prepared for them? Well, whenever that time comes, you miss out. That's what happens. How about the second subsidiary point, being sober? Now, sober means to be calm and collected in mind, to be temperate, dispassionate, circumspect. Nice word for meaning wise. And sometimes the word sober is used as opposed to being drunk. Sometimes. Not all the time, though. He's not calling on them here in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13 to just abstain from alcoholic beverages. No, that's not it. I think what it would be is more like being clear-minded. And if you think about this word meaning to be clear-minded, of course it would apply to the drinking of alcohol, because that doesn't clear up the mind. That fuzzes it up. But then to be clear-minded about a number of things outside of that, to be sober in that regard. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 15. We go over there. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 15. Therefore, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise. And verse 16, making the most of your time, because the days are evil. So we ought to be wise about this, you know, to be sober, be clear-minded, to understand things, you know, like they really are. I think, you know, you almost want to add to that in when you see the be sober is, you know, don't be deceived by other things. It's so easy to be deceived by this and then, you know, and not be clear-minded on things. Obviously, if you're deceived, you're not clear-minded. So we ought to be wise about certain things. Like what? Well, how about a few things here? How about our companions? You think? Now, I'm not talking about people that you work with. I'm not talking about where you got no choice. We're talking about where you do have a choice. Yeah, you know, I worked 18 years at that gypsum factory. And there were a lot of guys there. I liked to work with them. They knew what they were supposed to do. It made things easy for everybody. You could talk about a lot of things, and they were, most of them were pretty good. If they were talking to me about certain things, they didn't talk about things that were, you know, sinful and other things like that. And even though I might like them in that capacity and enjoy working with them and so on, there wasn't very many of them I'd want to go on vacation with. We did go on vacation with one person, his wife. They had kids our age and all that. That was a little different. Once in a while you might find somebody like that, but most of the time, no, I didn't have any use for this. I didn't want to go hang around the bars of a night. Some of the other things. There's a choice that you make. I didn't make a choice necessarily to work with them. They were there. And that's what happened. But I do have choices sometimes. You have choices sometimes. Well, what do we do about this? So we ought to think about our companions. Now back in the Old Testament, in Psalms 1, the very first psalm, and I really like it. Boy, I'll tell you, it is clear and gets right to it. Verse 1. How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. Made a choice there. A good choice. Wise choice. How about the one there you see next on the screen there? Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 20. He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. Well, we can understand how that kind of a thing works, right? And then there's 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 33, which has been variously translated in various versions, sometimes in some interesting ways. I got 14, it's 15, I'm sorry. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33. Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. Well, that's exactly what happens. If you think that you can bring other people up that have bad morals, maybe you can, but what's going to happen more than anything else, they're going to drag you down. So our companions, we ought to be wise about that. And we also ought to be wise about being chummy with the world. I couldn't think of a better word from that, but I thought, you know, chummy with the world. Just being too close. Too close. And there's a lot of reasons for this. The first one is, and I know this is pretty frank, but I don't know how else to do this. The world is obsessed with sex. Again, where I used to work, I walked into the parts room one time. Here's the new calendar on the wall, and it was from McAllister. And McAllister sold heavy equipment, front-end loaders, scraper pans, all kinds of things, heavy rock trucks and so on and so on. And here's a bulldozer. A McAllister bulldozer. And there's this girl in a bikini on top of the... What does a girl in a bikini have to do with a bulldozer? Nothing. Why is she on there for? She's on there because of the sex appeal and sex sales. It's just obsessed with it. Stop and think about it. What's the big thing that's going on right now? You can't hardly get away from it on the news. Look at the number of people. Sex scandals. Whether they're current in the last year or two or whether they're 30 years old. Doesn't matter. All this breaking out. And I'm thinking to myself, and so much of it coming from people in Hollywood. We were talking about this at lunch. I'm amazed. Who would have thought that Hollywood and everything that they produce and the lifestyle that they live, which they brag about and joke about and laugh about all this,
just filled to the brim with sex. And now all of a sudden, people are coming over here and, shame on you, you shouldn't be doing that. They've got to just be sitting there having no idea what's going on. The old expression, they must have looks on their faces like they've been hit in the face with a wet mop. Who's surprised by this? That it's all blowing up now. But the world's obsessed with that. So we should be chummy with the world? I don't think so.
Also, the world is unconcerned about alcohol and drugs. Same thing. Same thing. Unconcerned about it. It's just fine and dandy. I was amazed. It was back when we were living in Arkansas. I was amazed. I heard that the counterpart to the American Medical Association in England put out a report. Now get ready now. And they called alcohol, that kind of alcohol, a drug. And I thought to myself, whoever wrote that report is probably in Denmark now. You know, they've run him out of the country. But it's right. There was just an absolute firestorm over this. That's exactly what it is. Who thinks about that, though? Does it alter the mind? Does it change behavior? Everybody going on. I just wonder. It's a terrible thing when someone breaks into a church with an assault or a school or anything like that with an assault weapon and kills a bunch of people, 26 people and so on. How many people has alcohol killed this year? How many? The opioid problem we've got, everybody says, in the Cleveland area. Okay. How about an alcohol problem? You have people get all boozed up, get in their car, drive down here, and kill somebody unexpectedly. How many? And drugs? We're seeing things reverse itself. Again, I've been saying this for quite a while. Marijuana is heading towards being legal. And tobacco is headed towards being illegal. Does anybody find that ironic? I find that ironic. I'm opposed to both of them, by the way. But I just think, look at this. How everything's just getting upside down. What's happening to the world? Well, that's because the world's got no moral standard. They got nothing. It's just whatever it is today, and tomorrow will be something different. And we're going to be chummy with this? And this is the idea. I can do this. I can be chummy with the world, and that's being sober? Really? No, I don't think so. And I know that you don't think that. How about James chapter 4? We'll look at that. This will be our last passage we're going to look at tonight. James chapter 4 and verse 4. James chapter 4 and verse 4. You adulteresses. Now I think that means spiritual adultery, by the way. Do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? There's no way then to be friends with the world, is there? Based just on that right there. Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself a friend of God. No, an enemy of God. That's kind of sobering language there, isn't it? And could I just throw out one more? We know about 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, don't we? Be sober. Be vigilant. For your adversary, the devil, walks around like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. So that's what he's doing? What should I be doing? Being chummy with the world? That's what he'd like. No. We should be sober. We should be wise. We should make choices. and we ought to make good choices. And is that going to have a bearing on the hope that we have? Well, of course it is. And we know that. Now the exhortation, take your songbooks, turn to Songs Been Selected. The exhortation in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 13, illustrates that being a Christian requires some serious effort. We cannot be idle, but we must always be aware of our duty. And so, we ought to be diligent in doing that. I mentioned in the introduction there just a few moments ago about hearing those words, well done, good and faithful servant. The faithful servant. The faithful servant. The one who's girded up the loins of the mind, the one who's been sober, the one who's kept the hope fixed firmly on the goal. That's the faithful servant. Are you one? If you're not, would you become one tonight? Could we help you to obey the gospel? If you need to make correction, we'd be happy to help you with that as well. Whatever the case might be, if you're subject to invitation, why don't you come all together, we stand and sing.